Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Opto Sessions. I'm very excited to introduce Nick Pococo, Chief Security Officer at Kraken, which is a top-tier crypto exchange founded back in 2011. How are you doing, Nick?
I'm doing great. Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Where are you calling from today?
I'm in the United States, so I am in the States.
Whereabouts in the States?
In Chicago.
Oh, cool. Yeah. I don't think we've talked to someone from Chicago on the show. Is it so we're coming out of winter there now, and is it a bit brighter?
Yes, yeah, it's starting to get a little nicer. Yeah, it's starting to get into the, you know, like June is probably the best time of year here. So, but yeah.
Do you have quite extreme, so is it really cold in the winter and then pretty hot in the summer?
Yeah, it definitely is. So in the summer, it could be in the 90s Fahrenheit, and in the winter, it could be negative 10, negative 20 Fahrenheit. So yeah, there's a big swing. I think it's greater than 100 degrees.
And Kraken's a fully remote company, is it?
Yes, it is. Yeah. So Kraken, I think from its start, basically, at least as long as I've been at Kraken, and I've been at Kraken for 6 years, we've been fully remote. So even when COVID hit, right? So, you know, everybody, you know, started scrambling, the entire world was shutting down. I have peers in sort of, you know, either in the crypto industry or the security industry in different security roles. And they started asking, like, what are you guys doing about, you know, everybody having to go home and work? And I was like, we're not doing anything. It's just normal for everybody. It was like, you know, we're basically fully remote. It didn't really impact us. Yeah, there was no like real negative impact, I think, of like the working of COVID, because it was just normal for people. The actual like upside of it was that people didn't have anything else to do, right? Like for many people that like were in cities like, you know, like Chicago, you couldn't do anything, right? So you basically just stayed in your house. It was either you worked or you watched Netflix, and that was basically it. So I think a lot of people spent a lot of time working more, right? And jumping on group calls and having like some social stuff with coworkers, like on Zoom, because there was nothing else you can do. So.
But Kraken still has offices around the world, or?
We do. Yeah, we have offices mainly for where we need to have a presence for regulatory reasons.
Okay.
We'll have a physical office, but it's not a place where employees, you know, go to on a regular basis. In many cases, there are some people that go to offices, but the vast majority of Krakenites is what we call them. The vast majority of Krakenites do not go into an office, and likely even maybe as their for their entire tenure at Kraken may never step into an office at Kraken.
Yeah. I thought we could start just if you could give us a quick overview of Kraken for those that don't know, and possibly touch on some of its unique selling points in the market, or, you know, even if it's just one point you'd like to touch on.
Yeah, certainly. So for those who aren't aware, Kraken is one of the world's longest standing and most secure crypto platforms. We've been around for over a decade. Our mission is to drive and accelerate the global adoption of crypto, so everybody in the world can achieve financial freedom and inclusion. Like that's the goal of the business. That's why we exist. We have, you know, Kraken clients that come to our platform. We have, you know, over 10 million clients that use our platform, and we have around 200 different digital assets that are available, and about, I think, six different like fiat national currencies that are available as well on our platform. So for example, you can, you know, sign up for Kraken, log into Kraken, you can bring British pounds to our platform, and you can use those British pounds to buy Bitcoin, for example, or you can bring USD to our platform and buy Ethereum, and sort of any combination of those. And we have about 200 different digital assets that are available. So I guess some of the differentiators are some things that we pride ourselves on. One is superior trading experience. You know, we spend a lot of time in our, in our performance, reliability, our UX, you know, and our support as well. So if people have issues, they don't email support and it takes 2 weeks for someone to get back to them. They don't call a phone number and have to wait 4 hours, right, in order to talk to someone. We have live chat, we have phone support, we have email support. And we pride ourselves in being able to help clients very, very rapidly to solve their problems. We also are really, like I mentioned before, we're really well known for security. So that's what I do at Kraken. So I run the security program. Our client security experience is very, very highly regarded. Our internal security is very highly regarded. We have industry certifications. We've won awards for some of our innovation that we've done within security. So that's a big piece for me, right? From my perspective.
Yeah.
We also have, like, as a trader that comes to us, right? Unmatched, liquidity as well. We have some of the leading markets, from a liquidity standpoint, whether it's, Euro or USD. Especially those markets are highly liquid for our clients for trading.
And in terms of your background, you've been in cybersecurity for decades, I think. Is that right? And
yeah,
is your experience mainly or most of it from the financial services industry?
So it's been many industries. So I started my first job doing security things, like getting paid to do security things, was in 1997. So that was my first job.
Wow.
And so it's been a while. So it's, so I think it's, 27 years, something like that. Later part of the 90s, all of, the early 2000s, all of the 2010s, and now into the 2020s. So my career's actually has been part of four different decades, sort of through the years. So it's been a pretty interesting journey. As far as like industries themselves, obviously last 6 years has been in crypto. Prior to that, it was more in what I would call security product and services arena. So designing and building security products for various industries, and then also providing security services to various industries. So at various companies that I've been part of or helped start, financial services has been a big part of our portfolio of clients. Technology companies have been a big part of it. Retail, stores and things like that. E-commerce has been a big part over the years. When e-commerce popped up, they need a lot of security people to help them stop getting hacked, right? So there's been a lot of things I've done in sort of many, many industries over the years.
So you've learned all the tips and like the tricks that hackers use to get in over time.
Lots of stories. Yeah, I used to lead a lot of investigations as well, forensic investigations. So part of the security services world I was in, it was forensic investigations, penetration testing, sort of ethical hacking, application security testing were sort of the categories of services.
And so obviously, we're here to talk about cybersecurity in more detail, which is a really important theme at Opto. Getting a lot of traction over the last sort of 5-10 years, people or businesses might be mainly spending a lot more money on cybersecurity going forward. It seems like the level and sophistication of attacks keeps on getting higher risk for these companies.
Yeah.
Can you describe cybersecurity in general and what sort of attacks companies face nowadays, what they should be sort of protecting themselves from?
Yeah, so I guess cybersecurity in general, to me, when I think about it, is you have a system someplace that has access to something valuable, and you need to protect that system, right? From bad people, right? From doing something wrong within that system. In the simple sense, it could be, like a server, and then you have a network and you have a bad person here and they're trying to connect and you're trying to keep them out, right? And it may be that you need to make sure that there's username and passwords to even access that system. It may be that you need to make sure that those systems are updated, right? There's the patches are up to date on it. So those types of, that's a real simple sense, but it's a very broad, cybersecurity is extremely broad. There's lots of like very, 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 there's a lot of domains that someone can go very deep into, in all of cybersecurity, everything from, like information assurance, information classification, data governance, like it goes on and on and on, right? And there's application, more traditional stuff like application security or network security or firewall security, even like all those things. It's very, very deep and broad. But in from an attacker's point of view, there's, it's, you just have to find one issue, right? You just have to find one way in. As a defender, you have to defend all the things that you're, that you have in your environment. And so there is a bit of an advantage to the attackers, to where they prey on victims that they know may have underinvested in certain areas, or maybe don't have the ability to invest in certain areas. So, with lots of money and lots of time, you can build a very, very robust security program. But many organizations don't have lots of money and lots of resources in order to do that. And the attackers know. So they'll target places that actually may have lots of money, but they just may be underinvesting in security. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of the perfect storm. Like, you find somebody who has all the money and they also don't really care about security, or they, downplay it, or they have like two people, and if 20,000 people in the organization, they have two security people, right? Like, something, you find out an organization like that, as an attacker, you could probably clean up, right? Yeah. And either steal data, steal funds, and do things like ransomware, right?
Yeah, and that still exists today. There's lots of companies that have underinvested.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, that still exists. Even though, I think it's depending on the industry. I think in the crypto industry, I think organizations have learned quite a bit in the last decade that if you underinvest in security, you're going to have a really hard time, right? Especially since the assets you have in crypto are not as replaceable as, like, say, like, if you have credit cards, or you have like digital goods, or you have physical goods, right? Someone hacks into your system and steals a bunch of credit cards. What do the victims of that do? They just get new credit cards, right? Yeah. They're not liable for the losses, and they get new. Actually, there is loss. Like, you as a merchant, if you were hacked into, you're liable for the losses that are associated with that theft. But like individuals, it's highly replaceable. But in crypto, it's not. Like, I hack into, right? I trick you into sending me funds, right? And through some social engineering attack, and I get the funds, and now you're upset and you want those funds back. There's no one for you to call. There isn't a 1-800 Bitcoin number. You can't call up Bitcoin and say, "Hey, I lost all my funds. Can I get a refund?" That doesn't exist. And so the amount of attention and the sophistication and sort of the robustness you have to build around a security program in crypto, I'd say far exceeds even traditional finance.
Yeah. Right? And so, what are the most dangerous types of cybersecurity threats are you protecting against at Kraken? Is that related to customer funds? Is that what you're focusing on the most?
Yeah, of course. It's not just customer funds. Customer funds is like the top of the list. Also have client data itself. So, we have data on our clients, right? We have their email addresses, all the stuff that they have to do in order to KYC themselves, and how we communicate to them. So that's important to protect. The client funds are obviously extremely important, right? That's like one notch above even the client data, because that could be catastrophic for individuals, right? Even. And then you have, internal data, internal knowledge, source, like all the things that we use do behind the scenes as well is important to protect. And so what we see, Primarily, we see a couple of different things. One, we see social engineering attacks quite often.
Can you describe what those are? Sorry.
Yeah, so we'll see things like someone on LinkedIn will reach out to an employee at Kraken and say, "Hey, I'm a business partner. I'm from maybe they're from some blockchain that we support on our platform." They'll have a fake profile. "Hey, can you connect me with these people? Or can you tell me about what's going on?" And they try to get information. So we see those types of things. We also see people trying to call into our support desks to try to say, "Hey, I can't access my account. My name is Nick Prococo." "Okay, well, what's your email address?" "Oh, I lost access to it. I don't remember." Like, trying to convince, the support agent maybe to give them access to Nick Prococo's account, right? Like that kind of stuff. We also see phishing attacks against employees as well. So someone will, email an employee directly and try to, get them to do something, right? Sometimes it might be they try to get them to open an attachment. They try to get them to click on a link. They try to get them to reply with some information, right? Like those types of things. they'll try. So that's like in our business world, that's what we see most often is, you know, and then outside of our, like our core business, we also see things against our things that are targeting our clients as well. So very different, I think, from like our stuff is very targeted or focused and very, you know, very nuanced, I think, when they target our employees. When they're targeting clients, it's more of a, in many cases, it's more of like a spray and pray kind of thing where they will blast out fake looking emails to like some email dump that they obtained from some other crypto data breach with hopes that there are some Kraken clients in there. They do the same thing with Coinbase clients. They do the same thing with Binance clients. They'll just spray and say, hey, your Binance account is being locked. Click here to like make sure that doesn't happen. You'll get the next day, you'll get one that says your Coinbase account is getting locked. The next week you'll get one, your Kraken account's being locked. They just are trying to find, you know, they know that most people, if 99% of the people just go, ah, this is garbage and just delete it, they know that that's likely going to happen. But if they get 1% of the people to click on the link and do something, that's where they get paid. That's when they get paid.
And so what sort of things are you doing at Kraken to protect from cybersecurity threats? And especially things that you might be doing that other companies might not. If you're, you know, if you're pushing the frontier of what's possible to protect against cyber, what does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, for us, it has to do with giving the tools to our clients to protect themselves in the best way. Right? Like, you know, even from like, you know, there's a lot of financial institutions. There's even some trading firms out there, trading platforms out there, that it's like the security controls is that you as a client have in your account is pretty limited. It's typically like the baseline stuff is you have a username and a password, obviously. And then maybe you can have Google Authenticator, right? Or maybe it's just SMS 2FA, right? Like something pretty limited like that. There's no sense of device management, like how you can, you know, how you approve devices that connect to your account. There's often no sense of like using, you know, higher standards of two-factor authentication, like allowing like a YubiKey to be at or pass keys, which is something we just actually rolled out globally on all of our platforms, is our pass keys for all our clients. So our clients now have the ability to, with their account, they can add up to 5 different pass keys to their account. So not only is it redundant for them, but they could have multiple different devices. Then when they try to log into their accounts, whether logging in on web or logging in on their phone, it's almost like infinitely flexible of how they can authenticate in a very strong way. And so they might have a YubiKey as one pass key. They might have, you know, a mobile phone as another pass key. And when they go to log in on web, like they go, like for maybe they're a pro trader, they go to our pro interface, they put their username and password in, it's going to ask for their pass key. Maybe they're traveling and their YubiKey's in their safe someplace at home. And they're like, oh, okay. Well, all they have to do is, you know, scan the QR code with their phone. Or they can, issue if it's like more of a roaming or a cross device pass key, they'll just get like a push notification on their phone and they'll do a face ID and they get authenticated. We want to make it as like seamless and like easy to enroll as possible so that clients, one can easily just turn it on and it's like almost a no brainer for them. But then they also can make sure they don't shoot themselves in the foot and get locked out of their account. Which happens when you lose a 2FA method. Right? If you lose your 2FA method, what do you do? And so we want to make sure it's very flexible for them that they can enroll multiple devices in their account.
And what would you recommend for a customer? How should they be protecting themselves? What level of protections should they be putting in place?
Yeah. So what I recommend, well, one, you have to start before Kraken. So that's the thing. Like if you're a client that, is very weak security in their like everyday life, right? They use the same password on all of their different social accounts and they have no 2FA on their email account and all that kind of stuff. And then you go create a Kraken account. We can probably try to do everything we can for you, but we may not be able to protect you, right? Because like, as you know, if I hack into your Gmail, I don't know if you have Gmail, but if I hack into your Gmail account, it's probably the hub of a lot of accounts that you have out there. And I can go and I can do certain things with access to that account. And so the first thing we tell clients, or we want to make sure, right? You need to make sure that your personal life is secure first. So that would be put 2FA on your email account, right? You know, use passkeys on Gmail first, right? Like do that first. Then create an account. And then when you create an account, you choose a username. You know, you put your email address as your username. You get to choose a password. Hopefully you're using a password manager that's going to generate a strong password and you're not going to reuse it in multiple places. So that's key. The next thing is add 2FA to your account. And you know, use the safest method you can. So, you know, use a hardware security token like a YubiKey, or any sort of FIDO2 compatible key, or use a passkey. You know, you probably have a phone with you. It's an extremely strong way to, and something you have as well. It's an extremely strong, you know, piece of technology to cryptographically, validate that you need access. You should be granted the access to the account. So that's like the first phase. That pretty much, if you have a strong security on your email and then you have a username and a strong password and a pass key, it's pretty indestructible, I would say, from a hacker's point of view. Even if you were to go to a phishing website, the attacker might get your username and password from you, but they're not going to get into your account because they won't have the passkey.
Nice.
Yeah.
How does that passkey technology, how does that work? Because is this Apple only or not?
No, it's not Apple. So it's based on the FIDO2 standard. So the FIDO2 standard basically, you know, connects that device, the device that you have, cryptographically authenticates with the site you're connecting to, so that even if you go to a phishing site that's, you know, supposed to be like, it's like fakekraken.com, that key itself won't recognize that site and it won't work. The same thing goes with pass keys. And then your pass key itself, it's not just an Apple product. It's a global standard. So Microsoft has an implementation of it. Google has an implementation of it. Apple has an implementation of it. So if you're a person who has like an iPhone and a Windows computer, you could actually create a pass key with your phone and also with your Windows computer. And you can authenticate, you know, using either method, on the platform. So, very, very portable, from that regard.
And what about, wallets? Cause you obviously can get the app. So for, you know, if it's Kraken and then you've got an exchange app, but I think you've just released, a standalone wallet as well.
We did.
And then you've also got hardware wallets. So what would you recommend in terms of like crypto specifically, how people handle this sort of thing?
Yeah. If you're someone who's investing in crypto or trading, you're a trader in crypto, how I like to talk to people about it is that the funds you keep on Kraken should be funds that you're using for activities on Kraken, right? You don't treat Kraken as your bank account, right? If you are actively trading on Kraken, obviously you need to have funds on Kraken. If you're actively staking on Kraken, you need to have funds on Kraken, right? Like those are the utilities, you know, typically that you would do on Kraken, right? So if you're doing those activities, you need to have the funds to do those activities. Secure your account and you're safe. That being said, just like you do in sort of the real world, right? Like non-digital world, non-crypto world, I would say like the finance world, right? The traditional finance world, you typically have a physical wallet, like a wallet that you might have some cash in, and then you probably have like a safe, or you have a bank account someplace, right, that you store the rest of your money in, like a savings account. Think of that as well. You can apply that same sort of paradigm to crypto. So if you think of Kraken as the place that you want to have your funds for utility reasons, and then you also want to have sort of like your everyday spending and doing things in the Web3 world, you can have your Kraken wallet. So the Kraken wallet we released is not meant for people to have their life savings in. Although you can, right? You probably don't want to put your life savings on a mobile device. That is meant for you to use and explore the Web3 world. So you can buy things with crypto using it. You can send funds to your friends and family using it. You can, you know, connect to DeFi sites with it. And invest and do things that way. That's for like, you can mint NFTs with it, right? Like it's meant for everyday utility. Then you probably don't, like I said, you don't want to have your life savings on your Kraken wallet either, right? You don't keep your life savings on Kraken.com. don't keep your life savings in your Kraken wallet. Keep your, if you have your life savings, you want to keep that in something like a hardware wallet. And so what we, you know, that is something that is kept offline, right? Stored in a safe someplace, and something you only access when you need to move funds out. You can always send, like you can send funds from your Kraken wallet to your hardware wallet, or you can whitelist that address in your Kraken account and send funds from your Kraken account into your hardware wallet. And you can make it like a send only, like a, you're only sending put, and only when you need to move funds out, then you take that out of its safekeeping and you go through the signing, you know, signing ceremony in order to move funds out.
And I wanted to ask, going back to sort of what we were earlier discussing about, are there any sort of, what are some interesting stories about some niche ways hackers have tried to gain control of your systems, things that you've experienced over the years you've been in the industry?
Yeah, so probably, you know, obviously we see things all the time. We see, you know, things like credential stuffing attacks on clients' accounts, which basically, think of it as they get a dump from another data breach related to crypto. They know what the user, they know what the email address is. And now they're now, and they see that the password is something like not so great. So it might be like summer 2023 or something is the password that's in that like dump. And so what they'll do is they'll connect to Kraken and they'll try, you know, they know the username. They'll try summer 2023. Exclamation point. They'll say summer 2022, summer 2021, they'll, all the way back to like, you know, maybe 2014, like thinking maybe they created their account a long time ago. They'll try to log in that way. And so we do see those, from time to time, but we have safeguards, right? You also, if it's a brand new device that's connecting to your account, you also have to approve it. And so the attackers, if they guess the username and password and the client doesn't have 2FA, there is like there is a backstop there, right? The client has to approve it in there. So we see those types of attacks. Attacks against Kraken. There was an attack that was publicized a couple of years ago, where the and this was publicized actually by Coinbase. They went public about the attack, but it actually targeted Kraken and a number of other exchanges. But there was, I think it was like a professor or someone at, I think it was Cambridge University or one of the universities in the UK that had their email account compromised. And then they used that professor's email to send legitimate sounding emails to people that worked at exchanges saying they want to collaborate. I think it was like some research collaboration. They just didn't send the attack right away. So you got this email and you're like, oh, okay, yeah, I'm interested. And then they followed up with like a PDF. And the PDF had an exploit that would it would exploit Windows computers in the environment. And
you just had to open the PDF. That was it.
Yeah, you just had to open the PDF. I don't think I would call it zero day from what I remember. But it was a it was more of like if the computers aren't up to date, there would be some problems, right? They can get a connection, they can drop malware onto the computer. And I know Coinbase detected it and stopped it in their world. In our world, we have lots of scanning that happens on inbound email, as you might imagine. Pretty common for someone to send, you know, weird things to us. So, those types of messages ended up getting, they got caught up in some quarantine. And reviewed and detected by the security team. But had we not had that in place and it went to our employees and the employees, you know, that they were targeting were like, you know, folks like business development people who want to do like partnerships. And so they would have been like, oh yeah, hey, let's talk. Seems legit, right? It's coming from this legitimate university, professor I can see that's involved in maybe fintech and crypto. Yeah. And sure enough, then they would maybe have some problem on the computer. So we sort of avoided that one.
And how do you, I'm assuming these hacking groups are keep on coming up with novel ways of trying to, you know, get into your systems. How do you keep up with this sort of thing and stay ahead
of it? Yeah, so a lot of it, you know, we have, there are communities within the crypto space, especially folks that are running crypto exchanges and custody providers and things like that. There are some industry groups that one that's actually I can't really talk about yet, but is in the works, that'll be announced I think later this month, basically it's an information sharing consortium essentially, where if we're seeing attacks against our systems or against our clients, we're going to share that those IOCs, basically those indicators of compromise or those signatures. We'll share that with the community so that they can ingest them, and then they can, because what happens in the attackers, they're going to go try these things at Coinbase, then they're going to go try Kraken, then they're going to go try, you know, against crypto.com and Gemini and Binance, and they're just going to, the same types of things that other, they just recycle them and they see what sticks. Maybe they had no luck at against one company, one crypto exchange, so they're going to try it against somebody else. And so we see those, and then even the stuff that we see against our clients, we're going to try to start sharing more of that, so that, you know, these are the devices that we see that are targeting accounts. Here's what the device fingerprints look like. Here's the IP addresses, like that kind of stuff as well, so that it'll make it that much harder. The whole idea is we're never going to eliminate the criminals. They're always going to exist. There's been criminals for thousands of years. But what we want to do is we want to raise the bar, make it more difficult. So the method of like, oh, let's attack Kraken clients, and then once we run dry there, let's go look at and attack Coinbase's clients. The hope would be Kraken sees them. We package up what they look like, hand it over to the industry consortium, and then Coinbase and other people ingest that intelligence. And by the time they make their way over to Coinbase, it doesn't work. They're protected, right? Those clients are protected. So that's the idea. We want to raise the cost for all attackers. It doesn't do us an advantage, any good for us to basically say we're not going to share, and we're just going to protect our clients by not sharing, because any success they have at any of our competitors, that gives them more funds that they can then use against us, right? They can then start buying 0 days and they can start doing things. And so if, as an industry, if we're able to raise that level of sophistication that's needed, or raise to a point where like they just potentially give up on those attack vectors, that's great for us and it's great for everybody.
And am I right in saying you have white hat hackers in your team that are trying to hack your systems to find flaws? Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, we have within my security organization, I have a couple different groups of what I would call white hat hackers. I have our red team, and I have some. Then I have some AppSec and application security engineers that sort of fall into that category. And then I have folks in a group that's called Kraken Security Labs, which are more of your security researchers. And so, so I have like three different groups where they have similar skill sets applied in different ways. The red team essentially operates on a campaign, process, on a campaign cadence, essentially. So think about, they come together and they say, okay, we're going to be North Korea today, right? We've studied sort of the tactics that North Korea does, how they register domains and how they do things and how they write custom malware even. We're going to do all those things for a couple of weeks, and then we're going to launch it against various targets within Kraken, and we're going to see how successful we are.
Don't pay employees, or say so they sort of, you see how it reacts, they react to these sort of
things. We see how employees react. We see how our detections react, any tooling we have that is able to detect these types of things automatically. We see how those react. We also see how our blue team reacts. And so we have a 24/7, globally distributed blue team, essentially, that is any alerting, any anomalies that happen, anything that's going on in our environment, they triage those, and if they have to, open an incident for an investigation. And so when a red team puts together a campaign and then they launch it against our employees, which they don't launch it against everybody, right? Because real attackers don't do that, right? They're not going to launch it against everybody at the same time, because then you just have people in Slack saying, hey, I just got this email, right? Like what you want to do is they want to like sprinkle it in to try to get people who maybe aren't super active in chat communities and things like that. So they're going to target various individuals in different roles. And they're going to see how far can they get? Can they get people to click on links? Can they get people to download attachments? Can they get people to execute attachments? And then see how the blue team reacts, see how they clean up the situation, right? How they investigate, how they mitigate the attacker, and then, how they report it, through our channels and the things that we do internally in order to, like, how does it get to me? Like, how do I learn about this attack? Right? Like that kind of thing is also tested.
And do you have, is it denial of service types of attacks where they try and overload your systems. Does that still occur? Is that easy to get around, or is that a real problem?
At times it can be a problem. And so it depends on the type of attack that they're doing, right? So we've been very, very focused over the last handful of years on performance and reliability and, you know, scalability of our systems. And so, you know, we probably have people DDoSing us every single day. Maybe more than once a day, right? Like we have people that are trying to DDoS us, you know, various API endpoints, sites and different infrastructure. So, we have that happening constantly. Very rarely does it impact us, today. Because we've done things in our environment, we've learned from the techniques that they use over the years, that we've done things in our environment to where certain DDoS attacks and certain types of things have very little to no impact on our clients. And so it really comes down to how we've come to that place is by studying the attackers. What are they doing? What tooling are they using? How are they representing themselves to us? Are there ways that we can detect when they're starting and then do things so we waste their time, right? Yeah. And raise the cost. And so I don't want to go into details of everything we do there, but in case you have the DDoSers watching this video, but basically we have people. It's not like we get DDoSed and everybody just sort of like runs around and screams and then we just wait for the DDoS to stop. Like that's not what happens at all. When we see an active DDoS that's doing any sort of like changing of any sort of like performance and reliability in our platform, it's an incident. So most of those no one ever hears about, like, you know, but then there's constant improvement. We're like, what did we learn from this? Oh, well, if we change these things, it's going to make it harder for them. And so then we go and sometimes same day we boom, put in that change in order to make it that much harder for them. And then clients don't realize it doesn't impact clients at all. It doesn't impact sort of like the reliability of our systems. It just makes it more difficult for DDoSers and makes it cost more for them. And that's the goal.
And yes, there is a real cost to them making these sort of attacks. Longer it goes on, the bigger the cost is. And the cost is substantial, I'm assuming.
So the bigger, you know, they have infrastructure, right? So that, you know, there is like DDoS as a service out there. So maybe you pay, you know, maybe there's some benefit that they think they're going to get from a market perspective, right? If they DDoS Kraken, right? Or if they DDoS Coinbase, DDoS Binance, they take one of those exchanges offline. Maybe there's some like arbitrage. I don't know what their motivation is. Obviously it's, you know, occasionally we get the things like, there'll be a support ticket that comes through that says, hey, we represent this cyber army. We're going to DDoS you tomorrow unless you send us 100 Bitcoin. Right. And so like we get those and then we sort of like, you know, ingest that ticket, you know, and we look at it and we're like, okay, let's just like monitor what's going on tomorrow. And most of the time we see them doing stuff and it doesn't affect us.
Yeah.
Right. Like it's like very, very limited effect, to where like there's no client impact at all. And so, and then sometimes we learn something from it and we're like, okay, we're just going to make it harder next time, you know, increase the cost and still no client impact. And so that's what we do. Like, that being said, like roll back the clock to like 6, 7, 8 years ago, you know, crypto exchanges would get DDoSed and taken down, because the sophistication of like the defenses and the tooling that was available back then was much more limited than they are today.
Yeah.
To defend against those types of attacks.
And Nick, what about cybersecurity more generally? Do you see that as a industry just getting bigger and bigger over time as more and more threats are coming in? Maybe the advancements in AI are going to unlock some new things you have to protect against. Moving forward, is there more of a percentage of a company's revenue being spent on these sort of things?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're sort of at a little bit maybe of like an inflection point in sort of the cybersecurity industry. So, like I mentioned, when I first started working in the cybersecurity industry, if you went to a security conference, like a like an RSA or something like that, like RSA conference. You went to something like that in like the late 90s. There was maybe like five vendors exhibiting, 10 vendors exhibiting, and they're mostly like firewall products and maybe some like authentication products, something like that. Like that's all you would see back then. Today, if you go to something like an RSA, it's, you know, those who have been to San Francisco, it's held at like the Moscone Center, which is these giant, you know, giant exhibit halls, and it's completely filled with vendors. Like, you know, massive booths, right? Like big extravagant kind of displays and demos and all that kind of stuff. So the industry has grown tremendously since I started, right? Since I started in it. The problem that I think the industry has faced, over the last like handful of years, actually since I would say at least the last 6 years, and since I've like got out of the security industry and went into like, you know, working like, for, you know, working for real companies, yeah. I would say, right. Doing security for like in the real world, rather than just like recommending things and building products that other people are going to implement in the real world. You know, what I've seen is there's so many products and so many tools and so much technology out there. It's really, really difficult for security programs, security organizations at companies to one, decide what's going to be the most effective tool in their tool belt, or where should they invest? The other piece is, once you decide to invest in it, how do you actually manage it? Because there's this problem that I've noticed, you know, or I observed over years in working in cybersecurity. There's always this sort of model where you get a new solution in place. Everybody thinks it's really awesome in the security team, and they sort of, they do things with it, and its effectiveness sort of like, it's great and it works and it does all these things. And then over time, the effectiveness just sort of like slopes off, because no one goes back to like, no one has time to go back to like retune it or adjust it or whatever. The effectiveness just sort of like slopes off, and it's just this long tail of like, you know, it becomes ineffective. And so like companies will collect like dozens of those products over years, and they have all these products that like just aren't being used effectively because people don't have time to maintain them. So like managed security services is one solution, but then you end up in a situation where people are managing your systems that are completely out of touch with what's going on in your business. And that becomes a problem too. So I think AI is a big piece. Now, obviously, if you go to like a security conference today, every single vendor says they do AI. Like every single vendor says they have AI. Like it was machine learning for a number of years. Now every single vendor says it's AI, right? It's generative AI based or whatever. Who knows? Maybe they, you know, they just pump some things over to, you know, ChatGPT and they get some results, right? That's not what I'm thinking about when I think about, you know, using AI. I'm thinking, you know, thinking of the role of a security analyst, like a security analyst in your team, faced with, you know, maybe inputs from dozens and dozens of systems. You know, how do you best organize that and make intelligent decisions? What I think when I think of AI, I think of more of it from the sense of like, you know, putting yourselves in the seat of a security analyst on your team. You know, can you build an AI agent that is capable of ingesting more data points than an analyst, a human analyst possibly can, and coming to conclusions that then can be acted upon by an analyst. So instead of needing to have, you know, maybe you only have four analysts that are available to you in your organization. And when you have those four analysts, they just can't keep up with what's going on, in their world. And you need to raise that bar, right? You need to be able to let them, you know, consume and analyze more. So maybe you still have those same analysts, but the AI helps them actually sort of like have mechanized arms and do more with less. And so that's the idea that I think AI has the most promise, that can then, you know, automate, you know, triage for analysts, also can automate decisions. So if there's this, you know, you have this SOP, the standard operating procedures of when these things happen, well, the AI can make those decisions and then just put something in front of the analyst that says, hey, this is what you should do. Or like, this is exactly what the buttons you should click on. And maybe you get to a place where like, that's not even needed. And the AI can just do the things that are needed to defend the organization. But you still need those analysts to be able to, you know, tune and adjust and QA what the AI is doing. But it can do more, right? Maybe reality, you needed 15 security analysts, but you don't have budget for that. So you can still maintain this. Now you can raise it to where you have 15 security analysts with four humans. And that, and I think that's the promise of AI, specifically applied to in the security realm.
So the opportunity is there, but you've just not seen it yet. There will be some advanced AI software in cybersecurity, but it's not there yet. So, but the winner in that area will be pretty successful, I assume.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's somewhat there. We're doing some of that that I described here at Kraken. So we're especially in the area around vulnerability management. Yeah. So we're doing things where we have lots of different places that vulnerabilities can be identified in our business, whether it's our bug bounty program, whether it's static scanners, it's our red team, our AppSec tooling. There's a dozen places, just say, where vulnerabilities can be identified. Ingesting those, triaging those, prioritizing those, becomes a challenge at every company. Finding the right people to work on remediating those pieces, those issues is a challenge in many organizations. And then managing that remediation to closure is difficult as well. We've invested in internally built tooling, using AI, to help in various stages of that. Even to a place where we're using AI to do some analysis around risk acceptance as well. Sometimes there's a vulnerability that's identified, and obviously the risk may not be high enough for you actually to invest the time in remediating. Because the likelihood's extremely low, even though it's maybe a newsworthy vulnerability out there. Running around fixing 0 days all day, that are in the news can really wear on your teams. And so using AI to help go deeper and do some analysis on, the prioritization, of those vulnerabilities. And also then if we should risk accept something, it can go deeper and do better analysis on that. Or just go deeper and use more data points do it faster, especially when we're dealing with potentially hundreds of issues, right, in a large enterprise. So we're doing a lot of that, and then even to a place where it also is able to help us identify the owners of certain problems as well. We're utilizing some AI to help the vulnerability management team, again, like I mentioned, have mechanized arms, and we've seen tremendous results from that. Like 10x, 20x, the amount of remediation that we're able to do when it comes to vulnerabilities that are identified than we were in the past. So it's been pretty effective.
What was that term you used? Zero days?
So I use it. Yeah, so it's 0 days. Basically, that's a pretty old cybersecurity sort of hacker community term. What that means is it's a vulnerability that hasn't been disclosed or known. So it's not known to the public, and it's not even really even it's not even known to the vendor either. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of 0 day security research that goes on, or security research in general tries to find 0 days. What they do with those 0 days goes down a couple different paths. One path is they go down the bug bounty program path, and they find that there's a problem in an Apple device. I used to do security research a long time ago. I found with a coworker, Paul Kerr, we found a flaw in Apple's SSL implementation many years ago. We packaged that up and disclosed it to Apple. It was critical enough. 10 days later, Apple put out a patch for all iPhones globally. But what we could have done if we didn't have the ethical, sort of rails, we could have went to a nation state or some sort of vulnerability broker and said, hey, we have a SSL vulnerability that will affect billions of iPhone users so that you can intercept any of the data that's coming off those phones. What's the value of that? And there's probably a lot of value with that. I would imagine today something like that would probably fetch, $5 million, maybe even more in the vulnerability sort of broker market. So, and it would still be a 0 day. So now it's, someone paid us they paid us $5 million. We gave them the details, even the exploit, the code for that vulnerability. And now they're setting up, they're infiltrating networks to try to man in the middle, iPhones and intercept the data that's flowing through them. And no one would would know what's happening until someone detects it, and then it becomes a big issue. So they may be able to operate that 0 day and exploit people for days, weeks, and months before Apple discovers it or before anybody discovers it. And so that's what we're talking about, 0 day. What I mentioned.
Right. Thanks for that.
it's like something you can't patch for. You may not have like specific defenses for that issue. You probably have like adjacent defenses for that issue if you have a robust program, but you don't have specific defenses for that issue, and there's no way to patch it.
Thanks so much for a call. It was really interesting to go through cybersecurity at Kraken, dig deep into how people are doing it nowadays, and also help the consumers protect themselves. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we wrap up?
No, I think, this was great. I think for everybody out there, I think, sometimes security can be very scary. You heard me tell lots of stories and lots of things. I think for individuals, it's really the basics. So if you're an individual out there listening, you're like, wow, this is, now I'm super scared that I'm going to get hacked. The likelihood of you getting hacked is pretty low if you just do the basics. Have strong passwords, have 2FA everywhere, update your phones, update your operating systems, and you're generally going to be pretty safe. And then watch out for tricksters, scammers and stuff like that.
They're everywhere nowadays. Thanks so much, Nick. It was really, really interesting to go through everything. So thanks for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Have a good day. Yeah,
and you too.
Catch up soon.
Yeah, we'll talk soon. Thank you.